It's the Morning Show. I'm Shireen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers say understanding how a language has developed, evolved, and who's been a part of it can broaden our understanding of English as a whole. A dictionary under development will contain words and phrases that were originally, predominantly, or exclusively used by African Americans, creating a historical record and serving as a tribute to the people behind the words. Join in this discussion on the way this effort can unearth and preserve the long-buried history of African Americans. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John Bao is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, where he teaches anthropology, education, English, linguistics, and African American studies. He is on the advisory board for the Oxford Dictionary of African American English, which is planned for release in 2025. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much, Shireen. I'm happy to be here.
Oxford American announced in July that it's working on a dictionary of African American English. This is expected to be published in 2025, and you are on the board of advisors for the project. Why is this project important?
This project is important because the linguistic contributions of slave descendants have not only been misunderstood, but overlooked throughout most of the history of the United States. And yet the linguistic influence and significance beginning in slavery and then evolving through Black populations as they spread throughout the country is really quite substantial. And it's most evident in its present form with the pervasive global spread of hip hop and rap. But that unique linguistic history began during slavery, and the dictionary is an opportunity now to bring some scholarly focus to the words and phrases that have cropped up through the African American speech community.
Can you define this for us? What qualifies as Black English?
That's a great question, and it really focuses on the colloquial speech of slave descendants whose ancestors were enslaved in the United States, right? So when slaves first came to this country and were sprinkled throughout plantations in the South, one of the most important things that happened was it was illegal to teach them to read and write. So the English that they were exposed to on plantations, typically in the fields, cotton, tobacco, sugar, was the language of the slave overseers. And very often they were white indentured servants from Scotland and Ireland, and they were not educated speakers either. And so the varieties that emerged were a unique combination of the English language and then some African retentions in one form or another, either words, phrases, or semantic classifications that kind of drifted onto English words.
Can you give us a few examples of how African American English can differ from other forms of American English?
Yes, I can, and I'm happy to do so. So one of the advisors on the project is my former colleague, John Rickford, at Stanford University. And years ago, he did an important study on the word Ben, B-E-E-N, as in I've been here, right? Except that in this particular instance, he noticed that when the word Ben had heavy stress, it often meant something different than if it was said without heavy stress. So if someone asked, is your sister still married? And you said, oh, yeah, she'd been married, right? Mm-hmm. That means she's no longer married, but she used to be married. But if somebody said, oh, she'd been married with a heavy stress, that means not only is she married, but she's been married for quite some time. The reason that that's significant is the meaningful differences due to tone. And English is not a tone language. And so how did that happen? Well, what happened was slaves, when they heard the word Ben, began to impose this tonal distinction out in the fields. It became very productive, and then it fossilized and carried forward, and it's actually spilled over into other dialects. So some people may say, oh, I do that with the word Ben. They just don't realize that it came about by way of slavery and tonal influences from African languages.
Oh, that's fascinating. We're talking plans for an Oxford Dictionary of African American English. John Baugh is the president of the Linguistic Society of America. And John, how do linguists explain the difference between dialect, accent, and slang? They're all separate things.
Yeah, so we'll hold off on slang for a second.
Okay.
But the easiest distinction between dialect and accent is dialects have unique grammatical properties. Right. So when we refer to African-American vernacular English as a dialect, the example that I just gave with stressed bin, another that you presented at the opening of the show, the difference between is or be, those are actually grammatical. But accent, for the most part, is pronunciation. So, you know, and within your beautiful state of Wisconsin, right, some people pronounce it Wisconsin. Right.
Yes.
And that's an accentual difference rather than one that has to do with dialect. And accent and dialect weave together in an interesting tapestry. And people can be forgiven for not maintaining that linguistic nuance that we professionals do. Slang is a completely different thing in the sense that slang occurs when a word that has a fairly well-established meaning is adopted by a subgroup within the speech community and for either an enduring or a short period of time, the word or phrase takes on a slightly different meaning. So the word chill obviously originally meant being cold or having to, but chill to mean relax was a slang expression.
I want to circle back to the accent thing for a moment because
absolutely, look, Shireen, it's your show. We're going to do what you like.
Oh, I'm just curious about it because when people from Wisconsin go to other states, they know right away that we're from Wisconsin, or they say, "Are you from Canada?" They can tell.
So, how come?
Accents are so regional. How did that happen?
Yeah, well, no, that makes perfect sense. Think about England, you know, even if it's London, East London versus West London, right? The Queen sounds very different than those that speak Cockney. And your regional accents have to do with class and education distinctions, as well as the fact that people live in different locations. So the Southern United States, which has a very distinctive dialect and accent, that was influenced by the fact that the settlers in Jamestown came from a different part of England than those that settled in Massachusetts that came from Plymouth, England. And essentially, it's because you live in different locations. Also, people have a difficult time hearing their accents. One of the best things I can do on this show is to let your well-educated audience know that a lot of people who say, oh, I don't have an accent, unintentionally are making a mistake. Everyone that speaks has an accent. What they mean when they say I don't have an accent is that the manner in which they speak doesn't really call prejudicial attention to itself in their day-to-day life. But, you know, if you don't think you have an accent, you know, get on a plane, fly 2,000 miles, get out, ask somebody if you have an accent, and they will say, yes,
you've got it.
So it's relative, you know, depending upon where you are in the United States. People think we don't have an accent here. Somebody has an accent someplace else. Makes my job fascinating.
John Bao is on the board of advisors for the Oxford Dictionary of African American English, which will be published in 2025. We'll talk more with him after this pause. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward, and for Kate Archer Kent, you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, and for Kate Archer Kent, we continue our discussion about the contributions Black Americans made to the language we commonly use today as an effort is underway to create the Oxford Dictionary of African American English. Join in this discussion on the history of African American English and its impact on the broader English spoken in this country. Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. John Bao is professor at Washington University in St. Louis. He stays with us. John, did Africans who were enslaved in America keep speaking their native languages as time went on?
That's a great question. And no, they did not. And in fact, that unique linguistic distinction is often lost on many people, because Americans very, very much philosophically want to treat everybody the same, right? And as a nation of immigrants, there's a commonality that people share when they think of their ancestors, you know, regardless of race, coming from a country where English is not spoken. And then gradually the families learn English. And if they're well-educated, they learned the local educated variety. Slaves have a unique linguistic history in comparison to every other immigrant group. And the reason for that is when they were captured on the west coast of Africa, whenever possible, the slave traders would separate the slaves by language. And that was to break down communications to limit uprisings, you know, either in the slave factories or in the Atlantic crossing. And so what happened was breakdowns in the indigenous African languages started to happen even before people boarded the slave ships. And then once they got to wherever they were sold, they weren't really in a cohesive linguistic group. If you take any other immigrant group that came here on their own, the Italians, the Czechs, the Poles, Vietnamese, Koreans, the Russians, they always came with other speakers of their mother tongue. And so there were always enclaves in the United States where, you know, Polish, Italian, French, Russian were spoken, but no African language survived the Atlantic crossing intact. And that's hugely impactful on this project, as well as some of the misunderstandings of why there's a distinctive style of Black speech that, you know, many people assumed wrongly was due to laziness or lack of intelligence.
We have Jack on the phone from Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi there. I think this is a really interesting project, and it's good to give people a voice, a linguistic voice, you know, that seems to have been denied them, you know, for, you know, hundreds of years or so, assuming I understand correctly. And you know, there's a lot I don't know about this or about African-American English in general, but I guess my big question here, just to kick it off, is how do we reconcile teaching good grammar in schools, and I mean that in the most ethical way possible, you know, while respecting the grammatical nuances of something like African-American English, and I guess even in some cases incorporate, you know, ways of teaching African-American English alongside academic English, or kind of bridge this gap in a way, assuming there is much of a gap.
So I guess, Jack, thanks for the question. John, so how do we reconcile teaching grammar in the way that teachers want to teach it while not discriminating and respecting the way people talk?
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to thank Jack for that question, and especially the respectful way he asked it, because this the difference in the dialects has been so badly misunderstood that one of the best ways to help provide the education that all children need, and, you know, well, let's focus in on the special linguistic needs of children that speak African American English. They need to have fluency and literacy in the dominant mainstream language. What used to happen historically, and this came from my TED talk, was many teachers who were unaware of these dialect differences would often tell their Black students that they were doing certain things wrong, you know, that was ungrammatical, right? So one of the easiest ones is, you know, just about everybody on this call knows the word ain't. I ain't got none, right? Mm-hmm. Well, ain't was used by slaves all the time. So you take a Black child and they get to school, and the Black child says, you know, I ain't got no books. And the teacher says, you don't have any books, right? Well, if you treat I ain't got no books as it's ungrammatical, and I don't have any books as grammatical, you're doing it, you're introducing the difference in a way that says that a dialect is wrong rather than it's different. And to Jack's question, what needs to happen? And this is not information that's readily available in many teacher education programs, but for those that are teaching Black students in the inner city, you know, being aware of the dialect differences lets people point out that, you know, sometimes people say, I ain't got none. And even though we may not use that in schools, it's grammatical. It's just not used in formal or academic settings. And in an academic setting or in a professional setting, we, you know, express negation in a lot of different ways. And the word ain't covers a lot of territory. Isn't, don't, didn't, doesn't, right?
Right.
And so, you know, just looking at that one word alone and how it parses onto standard English provides an opportunity to say, here are some interesting dialect differences, and to do so in a manner that doesn't make inner city children like me feel like, well, I'm just talking the way I always talked, and why is that wrong? You know, and that has psychological impact on the students for those that are taught, you know, oh, you don't speak properly. That's ungrammatical, right?
Right. We have Joe with us from Star Lake. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the show. My wife and I are both musicians, and when we were in Italy not too long ago, we went out in the morning, the birds were singing, and there were a lot of bird song. And later, when we were listening to the Italians in this village speak, we heard sort of the cadence or the feel of this language of the birds, the way the birds sang there. I'm just wondering if there's been any research on the impact of the natural world, the sounds of the natural world, on the development of language.
Thank you, Joe. What do you say to that?
That's a great question, and it has to do with the difference between communication and language, right? So the answer is, I mean, there is some research on this, but sometimes it's very specific to the species. So, for example, whales communicate through whale calls, right? They're not using language as we think of it with words and syntax and grammatical structure, but they're definitely communicating to each other through vocalizations. Bird song, exactly good, right? Birds identify each other by their species based on these communication things. Anybody with a pet knows that their dogs or cats, you know, have vocalizations that communicate. Where this may or may not translate into human communication is whether or not humans, depending upon wherever they are in the world, adopt communication styles that have been influenced by animals, right? And some of that is controversy. So anybody that's heard a dog bark aggressively knows that, you know, humans can in anger do something that resembles that. Is that a crossover between the two species, or is that a commonality in, you know, how anger is conveyed among certain mammals? It's a great question. And again, most of the communication studies of vocalizations are species specific, but Joe raises a great question about, you know, whether or not there's actually crossover influence.
Up ahead, we'll talk more about the work going into creating the Oxford Dictionary of African American English with John Bau, the Margaret Bush Wilson Distinguished University Professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer Kent. What is linguistic profiling and what impact does that have for African Americans? Join in with your questions on how Black English is perceived in America and the assumptions made based on the voices we hear. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John Bau is a linguist who is helping to produce the Oxford Dictionary of African American English. He is the president of the Linguistic Society of America. You have done a lot of research on linguistic profiling. John, what is this?
I'm going to share that in just a second, but I want to give a shout out, especially since this is Wisconsin, because one of my early collaborators as a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, his name is Tom Purnell in the English department. And Tom was one of the earliest people that helped me with some of the experiments. And he is also the editor of the journal American Speech. So I want to give Tom and Madison his appropriate recognition and shout out for this research. But linguistic profiling asks the question, is it possible to discriminate against someone just based on the sound of their voice over the telephone? You haven't seen the person, you've just heard them. And the answer is yes. It is quite possible that someone can be denied access to goods or services that they request during a telephone call if the person offering those goods and services, for whatever reason, decides to deny goods or services that might otherwise be available based on stereotypes that they have about the person's speech. And Tom and I did some experiments in housing markets where we use the phrase, "Hello, I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised in the paper," or, you know, "that you have advertised." And I will modify my speech in the experiment. I call back and say, "Hello, I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised," or, "Hello, I'm calling about the apartment you have advertised." And so those accent differences, remember we talked about dialect and yes. accent, mm-hmm. those are just differences based on accent. Those with a background in psychology, you realize I'm the same person, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're getting a different reaction to those linguistic renditions, it's not because I'm a different person. It's because the listener is reacting differently to what they heard. And so we were able to demonstrate that in housing, employment, and trying to purchase home insurance, dialect matters and discrimination can occur.
How big of a problem is linguistic profiling?
It's bigger than a lot of people imagine, because when people are discriminated against in that way, they don't have a basis of comparison. And also, it's not just about race, right? One of the things about linguistic profiling is it can occur against any group of speakers that are perceived to be less than desirable. And in some instances, so we did some experiments, for example, where well-educated women who were applying for executive positions within a bank would call and were told that the job wasn't available, but men calling for the same position were told that it was available. So in that particular instance, the linguistic profiling takes place based on sex, not race. And we also have seen other instances where stereotypes based on someone's sexual orientation, based on speech, might be the object of linguistic discrimination by phone. So we began that research looking at it, you know, in terms of race connected to language, but it soon mushroomed into other groups that experienced discrimination based on other social categories.
We're talking about African-American English, along with a new effort to document it by Oxford Dictionary. With us is John Bao. He's an advisor for the effort and a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Marcus from Milwaukee is on the phone. Hello, Marcus.
Good morning. So I went to Wauwatosa West High School. I'm a Caucasian male. Where my last name ended up, I sat next to a gentleman named Antoine Perry. And so in English classroom, we'd have to exchange papers. We'd have to, you know, like look for grammar, you know, punctuation, so on and so forth, as English classes do. And one of the things that I came across was the word finna or finsta, which I was unaware, you know, of that particular word up to that point. And when I asked Antoine and another kid named Sam, and they just simply explained to me that that means like I am going to, or I'm, you know, like, or I will be doing this. And the teachers very much were of the opinion that that was incorrect and it was wrong. But now I, you know, and at the time I went, well, you know, it logically it makes sense. It's just a different way of speaking, especially since English is made up of, you know, how many other languages? I mean, you know, September, that goes back to Latin. So, you know, like with sept. So it's really what is English then?
John, what do you say to Marcus?
Well, thank you for that, Marcus. And let's just focus in on what Marcus said with the finna, you know, and, you know, I would not, I mean, thank you for that question, Marcus. It's really an interesting one, right? So finna is actually a reduction of the phrase fixin' to, right? So, and that goes back to actually white and black Southern varieties of English, where the expression I'm fixing to do something, right? So I'm fixing to go to the store, you know, I'm fixing to buy some shoes. It's non-standard for both white and black speech. But then in the black dialect, it got even reduced further to finna do something. And you're absolutely right. It means I am getting ready to do something. Preparing to do something. It's the non-standard version of that. But when black students are writing it on their English composition classes, it's because that's the language they use in their everyday life. And I used to joke about this particular phrase because of the intentionality. I used to teach at the University of Texas at Austin. And Texans have a very distinctive dialect. White Texans have a very distinctive dialect. And, you know, they're often very proud of the way in which they speak. And, for example, if your boss said, did you finish that report yet? You could say, oh, I'm sorry. No, I didn't do that. But if you said, I'm fixing to do it, that intentionality of, you know, it said, no, but I plan sure on getting it done. It kind of softens it a little bit. So another great question. You get, you know, Wisconsin. I love your state. I gave a lecture at the University of Wisconsin virtually last spring. And I was so sorry I couldn't get there in person to have more of the brats and beer and cheese that you guys are famous for.
Well, we love it here too, John. So I want to turn to Ebonics for a moment. In 1996, the Oakland, California Public School District caused a national uproar and backlash by proposing to teach children what was then called Ebonics. I know a lot of people will remember this as I do. Here's Robert Novak. He was a conservative co-host of CNN's Crossfire, attacking an Oakland school board member on the show in the 1990s.
Do you think that an African-American person can hope to make a success in most fields in this country if this person says he be going to work and uses the question, I ask you, he be going to work?
John, what do you remember about this controversy back in the 90s?
Well, I should plug my book, Beyond Ebonics, Linguistic Pride and Racial Prejudice, Oxford University Press, same publisher. And not only do I remember it, but I had to talk about it at some great length. I see we're going to go to a break soon. Do you want to take that now or?
Nope, you can continue. We've got
a
little
time
yet.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So very quickly, the term Ebonics is greatly misunderstood. But what happened initially was the Oakland School District thought they would be clever by characterizing their Black students as speaking Ebonics, which in some, not linguistic literature, but there is some literature about language that claimed that slave descendants aren't speaking a dialect of English, but a separate language. The reason that's significant in Oakland is if they're speaking a separate language, they might be eligible for bilingual education funding in the schools. And that put them on a path of, you know, notoriety that still reverberates today and unfortunately results in the fact that many school districts that have African-American students that speak the vernacular dialect just simply overlook the issue. And it has to do in large part with the backlash, the political backlash that grew out of the Oakland controversy.
John Bao is on the board of advisors for the Oxford Dictionary of African American English. He's a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. We will take that break now. You can join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing our discussion on African-American contributions to the English language and an effort that's underway to document them through a dictionary that will be published in 2025. Join in this discussion about what this effort will achieve and what it can tell us about the language we use today. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Linguist John Bao teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. He is the president of the Linguistic Society of America. He'll be with us for about 10 more minutes. John, we're going to go to the phone. We have Tom on the line from Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was going to mention a word pronunciation that actually you just used in that soundbite segment, speaking of Ebonics, the word X, used occasionally in the African-American community as opposed to ask. I think it was in the mid-1970s, I was listening to a lecture from a linguist, and he said that actually the term axe was used in colonial English, and even George Washington could have used that term. And I guess perhaps for reasons of segregation and isolation, the term axe has been retained in the African American community through the centuries.
Thank you, Tom. John, what about the word axe?
You know, Tom, thank you for that. So your callers are hitting the highlights on this one.
They are.
Because that is one, the difference in pronunciation between ask and axe is one of the features that is talked about most. So I want to thank you for that question. I would not have brought it up, and it's one of the most important. So Tom is actually partially right. the original pronunciation of oxion and oscion go back to Middle English in England. But that doesn't quite explain what's happening in when the slaves began to use the pronunciation axe instead of ask, right? So your callers who are native speakers of English that have children will no doubt know that when their kids tried to pronounce the word spaghetti, one of the first things they did was say paschetti instead of spaghetti. That process in linguistics is known as metathesis. It's where you switch the position of consonants and vowels. So we're going to get a little deep into the weeds here, but the word ask is a vowel followed by an S sound followed by a consonant. But axe is a vowel followed by a hard consonant followed by an S. And just in terms of pronunciation ease, a vowel followed by a consonant is easier to pronounce. And so what happened, in much the same way that kids would say paschetti, slaves would start to say axe instead of ask, right, as they're learning the language. And then it became fossilized. And why is that? Well, because the noun axe that you use to chop wood and the verb axe to axe a question, they never get confused in grammatical context. And so that productive distinction, you know, not only was maintained, but then also as, you know, younger members of the dialect who were proud to be Black speakers recognized the difference, they almost overemphasized, I asked you that, to call attention to the fact that I am a proud speaker of the vernacular Black dialect. And so during the history of the language, the consonant and vowels got inverted because of the fact that axe, the noun, and axe, the verb, are in different grammatical locations. They never get confused in actual speech, but it calls attention to itself because the pronunciation is so different. I'm going to also mention one that's from hip hop that probably won't come up in a call in the time that we have, but that's where the hip hop spelling of the slang word fat, as P-H-A-T, is another example of pride in this slave descendant dialect, because P-H-A-T used as the slang phrase fat isn't because someone thought that it was pronounced pahat. They know that the P-H in Philip, right, is that P-H is an F sound. Well, that's because you were in an English class, right? And they taught you that. And then the decision was, okay, well, if PH is F and I say fat city, but I spell it P-H-A-T, I'm actually using that to embrace the slave descendant dialect rather than reject it.
When we talk about embracing that dialect, how often, I'm curious, how often are African-Americans altering their speech depending on who they're talking to?
Constantly, but everybody does that, right? In the sense that every person listening has a range of formal to informal speech. The question is, what's your linguistic experience and what's your linguistic background? We're focused on African Americans. If they live in inner city Milwaukee and they have a job in a professional context, they may say, I ain't got none when they're at home, and I don't have any when they're at work. That's one range of formal to informal. You know, you probably have callers that, you know, may be bilingual. And if their home situation is one where they use Spanish and their work situation is one where they use English, then they're actually looking at, you know, formal and informal things across two languages. But even the Queen of England has a range of formal to informal speech. She's probably not likely to use the word ain't, but there are slight differences in her pronunciation depending upon whether she's talking to her son or whether she's giving a speech to Parliament.
Now I'm going to be obsessing over whether or not she says ain't at home.
We're talking. I think that's a safe bet.
No. We're talking with John Bau, a professor at Washington University in St. Louis, where he teaches linguistics, African and African-American studies, and anthropology. What do you hope that the dictionary you're working on achieves?
I hope that it provides an opportunity for people to look at this issue afresh. The clip that you played by Robert Novak is unfortunate in the sense of how many well-educated Americans are completely ignorant about the linguistic legacy of slavery. And, you know, castigate speakers of the dialect as, you know, corrupting the English language. When in fact, language everywhere in the world is malleable and makes adaptations based on the speakers that use it. And so if this dictionary does its job properly, it will allow us to look at this dialect in a scientific and objective way, and to recognize some of the important contributions. Just about every person that speaks English knows the word cool, as in that's really something quite neat, right? Mm-hmm. And cool is a slang word that has stuck, right? Mm-hmm. So, hey, that's cool. That's never gone out of fashion. But that's always been, you know, a slang word that started from the Black community. Right now, you're seeing an interesting thing happen. I heard a news story yesterday where Ron DeSantis in Florida is going against the woke culture, right? Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing also is that some of the slang, Black slang, is being weaponized in a political context. I hope that the dictionary helps us disentangle some of these more controversial things. And, you know, for heaven's sakes, why wouldn't slavery be controversial in the United States? Hopefully the dictionary will make this less so.
In the final seconds we have left, we have about 30 seconds left. Do you ever envision Americans speaking all the same type of English, or is it inevitable?
Never. Right. And people once, you know, often say, how come we don't talk like our radio and television broadcasters? It's because you talk like the people who you're around. And you also talk, you modify your speech to sound like you speak in a manner that's designed to get respect from the people you seek respect from. And that influences those linguistic changes. Shireen, you've been a great host. I've enjoyed my time.
John,
my only regret is I'm not there in person.
Oh, John, thank you so much. We really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
John Bell, the Margaret Bush Wilson Distinguished University Professor at Washington University in St. Louis and President of the Linguistic Society of America. I'm Shireen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.